Yes, now we will have a recording this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome today's guest. Judson Freed has over 25 years of emergency management-related experience and currently serves as Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for Ramsey County, Minnesota, home to the state capital of St. Paul. Judd serves on a number of government affairs committees, including Vice Chair of the Justice and Public Safety Steering Committee, Subcommittee on Homeland Security and Emergency Management at the National Association of Counties, NACO. He's Chair of the Government Affairs Committee for the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and also serves with IAM's Government Affairs Committee. And as a member of the Emergency Management Accreditation Program Technical Committee and as an EMAP commissioner, he helped write the EMAP standard. Please do see today's background page for further biographical info and links to related resources. Welcome, Judd. Thank you very much for bearing with us and taking the time to be with us today. And I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Well, thank you, Amy and Abhijeen. First of all, is the audio good? Can you hear me okay? And I'm going to assume that's a yes.
Yes, I think we're fine.
Okay. Very good, then. Well, thank you all for coming back. I appreciate it. Hopefully something that we'll say today will be worthwhile. So without further ado, I'll talk a little bit about where I am and what we do here in Ramsey County, and just to kind of put everything into connotation and into context for you. That red mark there, that's the state of Minnesota, and for those of you who are having trouble orienting you, the above that is Canada. I found that a lot of folks sort of don't know where we are in the nation. And Minnesota is a mixture state. We have a lot of agriculture, we have a lot of rural communities, and we have some real serious large urban areas. About a third of the population of the state lives in the Twin Cities metro area. Almost half, actually, lives in the Twin Cities metro area. Within the state of Minnesota, Ramsey County is located right down there at the little red mark there. It's a small county near the Wisconsin border, and we like it. Tell you a little bit about our counties because not one size does not fit all, and I don't want to pretend that it does, but Ramsey County is only about 170 square miles, of which about 140 some odd square miles are actually land, the rest being lakes. We are, however, the most densely populated county in the state of Minnesota. Our current population is something just over 520,000, and uniquely about 20% of my population does not speak English at home. We have 17 suburban municipalities plus a township, and the city of St. Paul, which is our state capital, is also in our county. And uniquely enough, Ramsey County has been listed as 100% urbanized now for about 20 years. So we have almost no land left to develop. People are packed in here. We're part of the Twin Cities Urban Area under the Urban Area Security Initiative grants, which helps and will lend a little bit of context to what I'm going to talk about today. And Ramsey County is in the top 30 most densely populated counties in the entire nation. And as the slide says there, we have over 3,300 people per square mile. Packed into 170 square miles, that gets pretty ugly pretty fast when anything goes bad. We are Minnesota's only home rule charter county, which proposes a few little unique things that we're able to do, although quite honestly, most of the time we don't act under our home rule charter. We just act like any other county does. Minnesota, you know, even though it's sometimes considered flyover country by the rest of the world, actually has been pretty active disaster-wise. We've had 6 presidentially declared disasters in my county alone since 2000. We have 9 law enforcement agencies, 10 separate fire departments, 1 countywide public health department, and 2 major environmental health departments ourselves in the city. There is some other environmental health work that's done in a few of our communities as well. There's no what they call Unigov here. We don't own and control all the assets. My communities do. And that leads to some very unique mutual aid arrangements and mutual aid need. The running joke around here is that if you spill a bottle of beer on the south end of my county, people on the north end fall over drunk. And as a result, everybody has to help anybody whenever anything goes wrong. The Twin Cities urban area is one of the six Homeland Security regions within our state, and we have a logo. That's going to become important in another slide. So we do have a logo. That makes us official. And as you can see in a little circle there, that's the Twin Cities metro area. And those counties, as I said before, account for something close to half the population. It's a little over a third, between a third and a half of the population of our state. It is sort of the northern end of Tornado Alley. We get a lot of smaller tornadoes, fortunately not too many large ones. And most recently, 2 years ago, a strong F1 went through downtown Minneapolis. Minneapolis is our largest city. It's a little over a million people. And struck in a economically depressed residential area. We had thousands of homes destroyed, and it was the same day that Joplin, Missouri got hit. So no one heard about us. We still have about 300 families that are out of their home and significant construction work going on. It was just one of those things that, you know, when you have a community that's completely devastated versus a big city that has a few neighborhoods devastated, you don't get as much publicity. And sometimes that can be good. We also, a few years back, had an interesting disaster which proved the worth of working together. Just in the very tail end of rush hour, the Interstate 35W highway bridge collapsed into the Mississippi River. Fortunately, we only had 13 fatalities and a few hundred injuries from that disaster. But it was of, when you lose an interstate highway, particularly one that really is the primary route up into Canada, it becomes a serious issue. And, of course, it caused all kinds of problems here. What it pointed out to us, though, was the value of training together. And as I'll talk about in a few moments, within our metro area, we've been training together really since the late 1990s and doing a lot of work together to try and coordinate things. So when the bridge collapsed, within about 5 minutes, we had five county emergency operations center that stood up their activities. And when the y'all come alert went out, our fire departments, police departments from all over the area began responding. And, of course, you know, as you might figure, those initial hour or two of chaos when you have that many agencies come in was rather quickly, though, corralled under incident command and using those tenets of NIMS. So even though I'm going to be critical of some of the things that Homeland Security and FEMA have imposed on us, I'm not going to be critical about everything, and I hope that will come through as we go. So where to start? I figure we'll start kind of around the year 2001. Back right before there, as I talked about, you know, in the late 1990s, I don't know how many will remember the Nunn-Lugar-Domenici Act. Under the Nunn-Lugar Act, they identified 120 large cities in the United States. Minneapolis and St. Paul were two of those cities, our Twin Cities metro area, and started encouraging training for weapons of mass destruction. There was a little bit of grant money for buying some stuff. But the biggest, most valuable thing that did is it got us started talking. In all honesty, before that, the major areas kind of kept to themselves. They didn't talk as much as they should. There was a lot of going for what's best for me as opposed to what's best for us. And things were kind of scary. We were really worried about how we would handle a large event. It was also a policy decision by some of our leadership to the point. At that time, I was director for the University of Minnesota system. And one of the things that was sort of clear is that our bosses, mayors and presidents of universities, didn't really want us cooperating, particularly if there was money on the line, with other agencies. So before Nunn-Lugar, we actually would meet in secret. We had a little group named after one of the people who kind of founded it, and we would meet for lunch, no agenda officially, and kind of had to do things under the table a little bit. With the advent of the Nunn-Lugar Act and some of this WMD concentration, it started to get a little bit better, and that would stand us well when the bridge collapsed because we had a few years jump on a lot of other people. Now, after 9/11, again, I was still at the university at the time, we started having a lot of demands to do something, fix it, whatever it happens to be. And if you remember, in October of 2001, that's when the anthrax attacks happened. And our law enforcement people in particular, who had gone through all that WMD training, were really I hate to say it, but they were really afraid. You know, when you can't see something, you know, these guys and gals got kind of nervous. And there was a big demand that we do something, get them the stuff they would need to be able to operate in that environment. My friend Bill Waugh refers to this as the crisis-driven policy window. And it's a basic reality that after every major event in the United States, the government, usually it's the feds, but all the way down to those locals, first lay blame, find out, you know, why this horrible thing happened, and then we develop a law as a reflex. You know, the post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act, the Sandy Emergency Management Act, all these laws that we just keep, the 9/11 Act, you know, we just keep throwing laws at things thinking that will fix it. Because you have to do something. That's the thought. Our cops needed to be protected from anthrax, so we protected them, and we bought them the PAPRs, the positive air pressure respirators. Sounded like a great idea. But looking back, once I came here to the county, looking back at it, I came to the realization that, you know, we probably could have done better with better training. The equipment made it very hard to be a police officer wearing that hood with the big air pressure respirator on it. And then, of course, there were the horror stories of some agencies that went out and put level A hazmat suits in the back seats of their squad cars that folks weren't even trained to use. I mean, so that some people reacted even worse than we did. You know, at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. I could have, in 2001 and 2002, I could have stood up in front of the news people and said, you know, we're doing the right thing. We're protecting our law enforcement, making sure they can protect you, the citizen. But now, here from, you know, the hindsight of 2013, we could have used that money, I think, a little bit better. And that will become kind of the guiding principle when I came here to Ramsey County. So I don't know how it works where you guys work, but in our county, when I first came here, everything was done individually. We have 19 separate municipal areas in our county. 17 are fully in my county, and then there's a couple that are we share with another county. And everything was done multiple times. We had separate emergency operations plans, separate approval for each one by the county's EMA. Everything had to be done separate times. Each of the municipalities received a pittance in EMPG grant money, and none of these communities had full-time emergency managers. All of the training and exercises were done separately and uncoordinated. And at Ramsey County at the time, there was a director, a coordinator, and a secretary, three full-time employees only. The problem was reconciling those differences so that we could respond together. And the very first thing that I did, and to me it's the one really right thing I've done, like everybody else, I'm not perfect, but the best thing I've done as the director here in Ramsey County is we went to a common county emergency operations plan. There are 147 separate items that Minnesota makes us do to be compliant with both federal and Minnesota rules and law. And to have part-time emergency managers who are also, in one case it's a public works director, in another case it's the city manager, in some cases it's a fire chief, in other cases it's a junior-level firefighter. They're the official emergency manager for their communities. But to have them do these checklists and meet 147 items, and then to have the county verify 147 items 19 separate times is insane. So in exchange for keeping the EMPG money, rather than giving a couple of $1,000 to each community, we keep it all now. We now have five full-time emergency managers here. I no longer have a secretary or receptionist, which sometimes is a pain. But in addition to myself, we have other people who work here. And then with grant money, we actually have some part-time people who work with us as well. And then we have 30 volunteers. So I think it's the one thing I can hang my hat on that we did right. So my local emergency managers then can concentrate on the SOPs for their community and not so much worry about whether they're dotting I's and crossing T's. And then the county, we coordinate what everybody does. We make sure that everything meets the rules and the laws, and more importantly, the intent of those rules and laws. And it also helps us to lean forward. You know, as FEMA talks about in National Response Framework, that leaning forward attitude, it's actually part of our emergency plan now. If there's something very bad, you know, not just a regular fire, but something really bad happening in one of my communities, one of my staff members goes there, and we let them send us home, but we don't wait for them to call us. So that's how we do things here. I understand not one size fits all. You may not be able to duplicate what we do, and it may not even work in your community, but that's what we've done here, and I just thought for truth in advertising, I should let you know. So as far as Homeland Security spending goes, the biggest question of all with these things, to me anyway, is how are we justifying our spending? There's been over $40 billion in Homeland Security spending. Congress is always on us for metrics and getting them numbers and that stuff. But what do we measure? I mean, how do we know even what to measure? And the biggest question of all is what about the risk? We keep hearing Congress talking about risk. But I found that DHS has a very poor grasp of risk. And if there's anybody from DHS out here, I'm sorry to say that, but I've said it to folks at DHS, and we'll continue to say it. Risk is a really important concept, and most of us don't really have a great grasp of it and don't have a great grasp of how to cope with it. And that's a problem. So all this money came out. And this just shows from fiscal year 7 to last fiscal year sort of how our UASI awards have gone down consistently. But interestingly enough, yesterday, DHS announced the UASI allotments, and our number is going to go up. We're going to get more money than we did in 2012, which goes absolutely contrary to everything that they've been telling us to plan for. The other thing that's very interesting is if you go online and download how the urban area grants were sent out, all that talk about risk has me a little confused. There's two tiers of urban areas out there, the very, very big cities, the obvious targets, the New Yorks, the Chicagos, the Los Angeleses. And then there's the tier two cities, the smaller ones with in theory anyway, a lot more risk than some of the other of those 120 big cities in the nation. But in looking at those tier two cities, those other ones like the Twin Cities, every one of them got either $3 million or $5.5 million yesterday. That's what the award is. So I'm trying to figure out in my own head, how is that risk-based? Why would the Twin Cities, and I'm grateful to get the money we're getting, but why would the Twin Cities get a certain amount and a ton of others get the same when there's a ranking that they do that's supposed to be about risk? There's reasons for that, and the biggest one is something that in my research, when I was writing my thesis and stuff, I found is something called Keeney's Error 1. The first thing that happens is that in order to achieve security, governments are willing to accept a degradation of some of their values in favor of others. So in order to achieve security, we will trade off, as a government, some of our understanding of the real risk just to get it done. And you'll see this at your local government. At the end of the session for your local state, or rather your state government, you'll find that a lot of bills will pass at the end just to get them passed. And people will sort of trade off sometimes even on their ethics. The idea is that this comes from an incomplete understanding of really what the objectives are. If the objectives are to address risk based on our actual risk of danger, I don't understand where those policy trade-offs can be allowed. Well, Keeney did. He's done the research, and this is a common occurrence. So what we are doing is we're just adhering rigidly to the laws that were passed during that crisis-driven policy window. So when I did the rest of my research, and I actually teach risk part-time at a local university here, I took a look at some of the findings from international insurance risk raters, and they say that the United States ranks well behind Spain and England and a number of other countries. We're only at a moderate risk for actual acts of terrorism. I know it's hard to say in light of what happened in Boston, but we are at limited risk. However, the occurrence of $1 billion weather incidents is actually extremely common, and we saw what might raise that high again just the other day. So we have lots of casualties from weather. We have a few casualties from terrorism. We have lots of likelihood of weather. We have few likelihoods of terrorism. But we concentrate mostly on terrorism as a nation, and that guided how we spent some of our grant money. So I don't know if you've read this or not, but this is what the Senate thinks of us. This was put out by Senator Coburn's office. And here's some quotes from him. We cannot secure liberty and guarantee security by spending more and more money. That's his first finding out there, is that we spend more and more money in the name of security. Well, they keep giving us more and more money, so obviously we're going to spend it. He also says that the preparedness grants were intended to be an initial investment to get us started on the road to being ready for these acts. And then he pointed out a lot of the waste. Now, the fact of the matter is that the vast, vast, vast majority of the money was not wasted. It was either used very well or was used to the best intent. Our purchase of those PAPRs that I spoke about earlier, again, in 2013, I look back and say, man, I wish we had done something different with it. But in 2002, they made perfect sense. It wasn't wasted money. It was money that perhaps could have been done better. But then we, emergency managers and homeland security professionals, become our own worst enemies. And if you look at that little quote there, somebody bought a fish tank. Somebody put a latrine on wheels. Somebody built a hog catcher and bought those with Homeland Security grant money. Now, they probably have some worth, but what we forget about is how they look. And that's a real important thing. We have to remember that politics is a part of what we do. So the theory behind what Senator Coburn is that what we do is no value, is supplanting local amounts of money, what is the responsibility of the locals as opposed to the federal government, and that we're full of waste. And that's what the public sees. They see these politicians get up there on TV, and they think this of us, that we have no value, that we are supplanting local responsibility by asking for federal money, and that the money that we get, we waste. So this is the single most hated purchase on earth, according to Senator Coburn. It is the armored personnel carrier for law enforcement. Now, I'll tell you that they're really useful vehicles. They are necessary vehicles. If you have an urban area SWAT team or something like that, you need something to keep your officers safe. But if you read the Coburn report, he damns them based on the idea that cities that have bought them have low homicide rates. Now, there's no correlation at all between the use of a Bearcat, which protects your SWAT team guys while they go in and helps you get injured people or the bad guy out of there while there's shots ringing out, and the homicide rate. They have nothing to do with each other. It's like saying that you know, you shouldn't drink water because butterflies are pretty. It means nothing. But it's the argument that we have to make, okay, is why do we buy them? We buy them because, well, there's not another one like it that's available soon enough. We have to justify that. What is available soon enough? If you can't answer it, don't buy that item. If you can't put a real life non-law enforcement, an emergency manager's answer to why we buy these, don't buy it, because it'll end up getting you in trouble in the end. The second most hated purchase is the command post truck. It was the first big purchases that almost everybody made. I'm proud to say that we did not make one of these right away. What do you need a command post for? How many command posts do you need? Argue this with your fire departments. I bet you they'll tell you they need a command post truck at every single fire. Other fire departments will tell you they don't need it at all because they can do it all from the back of their Ford Explorer. What other ones are available? We lucked out. We got to use one right at around that same time, and I had enough budget money to put the electronics in it and things like that. I didn't have to use any grant money on it originally. And then when we needed to outfit it to meet the needs of our hostage negotiation team and our SWAT teams, we have two SWAT teams out here that serve my suburban county plus a third one in St. Paul, we decided instead of it making it like everybody else's command post truck, we would make it an incident command post, a place where you could basically a mobile EOC on wheels, not a mobile communications center. We did that intentionally because there was nothing else like it around us. If we need a mobile communications center, we go and call for one from our neighbors. If they need a giant office space with computers to be able to run an EOC type of environment or to run a secure hostage negotiation in the event of something bad happening, or a place where our intelligence analysts can sit around and try and figure out what's going on if we have an explosion, our bomb squads use it as well, that's what our truck is for. Now that the thing is finally breaking, we're going to replace it, and we will use some grant money for that. But we've already proved that it's not going to sit in the garage, that we do use it on a regular basis. And all of the stuff that was put into it with grant money is getting moved into the new truck. So none of that is going to be wasted money. Again, it's more the political thing. I would love to go out and get it fully equipped and have, you know, all the bells and whistles. But politically, that's really not a possible thing. So I need to achieve the capability of having that kind of command post that can work with my hostage negotiators and my terrorist analysts, both, far more likely to have my hostage negotiators go out. They go out almost weekly than a terrorist thing. But I need to be able to justify that to the media. I need to justify that to the politicians out there. And that's a part of how we crafted our shopping and spending plans within our urban area and for using our grants. So what did we do when it comes to shopping and spending? We'll go into that. The first thing that we did is we looked at risk. The risk formula that most people use is that R equals TVC, probably seen that, threat times vulnerability times consequences. As someone who teaches risk, I can tell you that's a really simplistic view of the concept of risk. And it neglects what you do to mitigate. So if you buy a piece of fence, that building is no longer as vulnerable as it was. Every piece of fence that you buy makes it less vulnerable. There's no way to calculate that based on a simple mathematical formula of T times V times C. So in the end, by the time you finish that project, you're actually spending money on something that's less vulnerable. It's kind of a hard concept, but it's true. So when we're looking at things, we look first at something that's neglected in this common look at risk, and that's probability. In general, what we're instructed to do from DHS, remember Administrator Fugate calls the maximum of maximums? Well, that sounds really good at first. You know, we should be worrying about the 3-megaton nuclear device and the tsunami and all that good stuff. But by focusing on that, we start to lose a little track of reality. In other words, what is the difference to you if it's a 3-megaton nuclear device versus a 1-megaton nuclear device? What will you do if it's any kind of a nuclear device that goes off? We have very, very poor plans for responding to a nuclear device because my office is downtown and we'll be dead. This other thing that we do is we add attack in as if it's somehow more important than the effects of a tornado, and mathematically it's not. The reason that we add attack in there is because it's scarier than a tornado to most people. DHS also rates their risk by adding the probability of attack on a potential target, particularly critical infrastructure targets, to the loss of that target. So what that means is that a target with high consequences, if it's lost, but zero probability of ever being attacked, gets actually more valuable when DHS rates it than something that has a slightly lower consequence but that you know is going to be attacked. And if you take away the word attack and say hit by the bad thing, tornado, hurricane, tsunami, terrorist, just group them all together, you have something that has high consequence, extremely low probability, being ranked higher than something that is moderate consequence and 100% probability. We neglect the probability. There's even software out there that will do this for you, and one of the more common ones, and I won't mention what brand it is, we were using for a while in our urban area until we noticed a little thing that our elementary schools were coming out ranked as high as the nuclear power plants were. That's insane, quite honestly. So we decided to go away from that a little bit and look a little bit at relative risk and probability as something that we can do. The third little factor that flies into all that, however, is the theory that people worry about what is sexy. That is, people are far more worried about a bomb going off at a sporting event than they are about a tornado hitting that same terrorist event. We set up things like bag screeners and people in, you know, yellow coats who will pat you down as you try to go to your college football game. But what's the evacuation plan from that stadium if it were to be hit by a tornado? Which one is actually more likely to occur? And I would argue somebody throws a hand grenade into a stadium of 1,000 people, of 100,000 people, you're going to cause some serious injuries. If a tornado hits that stadium of 100,000 people, you're going to have a lot more impact. And yet, we spend a lot of money securing it against a terrorist attack and not so much about tornadoes. So what have we done here? First thing is we did is we assessed, do we need it, whatever it is that we're going to buy? So we looked at command post trucks. We looked at those PAPR devices. Do we need them or not? can we identify what it is that we want in advance? In other words, if we're going to ask for something, we have to sort of figure out what we're going to do with it before we spend it. And the biggest thing for me is, will we use what we get? We try really hard, and my one piece of advice out of all this is that you should also leverage every penny you get by using those items. Buying something that will only be used in the unlikely event of a terrorist attack, or that can only be used to prevent the unlikely event of a terrorist attack, to me is a waste of the taxpayers' money. You need to use something that can be used on a regular basis. Now, I do not mean the usual and customary equipment that your first responders rely on to do day-to-day. That's your local responsibility, in my personal and professional opinion. So buying the boots for your regular firefighters or their regular SCBAs, we won't use our DeGrant money for that, because that's just the cost of doing business for a fire department. We won't buy some of the routine stuff for our law enforcement or our public works or any of our agencies or public health. There does have to be some disaster and terrorism nexus, and the law says that it has to be a terrorist nexus as well, and we do comply with the letter of the law as well as the spirit. We follow what's referred to in risk as enterprise risk management, and that's the discipline in which you assess and control for and exploit and finance and monitor risk from all sources. And the idea here is that your purpose is to increase both your short-term and long-term viability. So you're looking at preventing bad things from happening, mitigating against those bad things, and being able to recover from those bad things. If you can do those three major tasks with anything that you buy, whether it's a thing, a piece of equipment, or whether it's some kind of a training that you can send people to, that's where we want to spend our money in our urban area. Can you justify it? Can you answer, Senator Coburn? We talked about the Bearcats and the tying into homicide rates. When we purchased a Bearcat, and we did, our local law enforcement people had to justify everything. They had to figure out how they were going to pay for it going forward. And we had to take a look at, do we actually use these sort of things? Are we requesting them? As it was, they were using a Bearcat. The problem was that the response time was a little over an hour for it to get here, and that's after it was called. So, that sometimes is 2 hours after the event starts. Now there's one, just one, in our county that we can use in all of our municipalities. It's maintained by one of our local law enforcement agencies, and the agreement is out there in writing that it is available to all of our folks as soon as they need it. And the response time is down into the tens of minutes, about 15 to 20 minutes to the farthest part of our county, from the time that the 911 call happens, as opposed to from the time that someone decides they need a Bearcat. So we've cut a lot of our time out. So I'm comfortable with having made that purchase. I got to tell you, if somebody came to me and wanted a second one, or even a bigger one, the answer would be no. You have to be ready to justify yourself. It's not fair, but it's reality. All of our choices, everything that we're going to do here is political. The Senate is looking at it. The House is looking at it. The media is looking at it. And let's face it, they don't like government. The idea is that if you can pass blame to someone, blame the government, right? And I'm kind of tired of it. I want to be able to get up in front of our local television station and say, yeah, I bought that, and not be worried about it. The next question that we kind of ask is there really an ideal level of preparedness? FEMA keeps talking about capabilities and capacities, but what are we trying to reach? What is the role of our state and our federal government as involves us at the local level? I'm not always sure that we look at that objectively. Sometimes we just simply decide that, well, the feds will pay for it, so let's go do it that way. Again, my view is real simple. Local emergency management's first and most important role is to deal with our local community, the people who pay us directly. If we can build a resilient local agency, then I can go out and help the agencies near me. If we're resilient in my little region of Minnesota, I can then send my staff out to help in other places. As a result, 2 years ago, when Minneapolis was hit by that tornado, I ended up as the planning chief in their recovery branch for 2 weeks. My county was able to let me go to the city of Minneapolis for 2 weeks there and work with them because we had a resilient agency back here. after Hurricane Sandy, one of my staff members ended up working in the finance section for the state of New York for a couple of weeks over the Thanksgiving weekend so that, we could help them out. The only way we could go and help New York was by first making sure that we're able to take care of ourselves here, because that's what my taxpayers are telling me they want done. Now, if every single community in the entire United States, if all 3,000 counties in the U.S. and all the big cities were able to take care of themselves to the point where they're relatively safe, then they can send help out when those catastrophic things happen. To me, that's the purpose of these federal grants, is to help locals fill a national role. And the final thing is, in thinking about that, is we have to figure out what is risk based on either maximum or maximums, or in my case, we use maximum of probable maximums or practical maximums. Okay, so we look a little bit differently than Administrator Fugate asks. Okay, we look at the real risks that Ramsey County faces. I have absolutely no hurricane plans whatsoever, but I do have plans in place to help shelter people from hurricane-affected areas. We look at what our current capability is, not so much the capacity. It's not so much a question of what toys do I own, but not so much what toys do I own as opposed to what can I do with the things that I can either get or that I have on hand already. And then we're willing to try and prove it. I'm a big believer in that FIRA process. I think the FIRA is the one good thing that the feds have done to us, with the exception of the fact that they've decided to treat threat and hazard separately. If you take a risk class, you'll find that threat and hazard, those two words, mean the same thing. We've decided in the United States that we have to tie terrorism as a separate event. Here in Ramsey County, I don't tie it as a separate event. I look at things that we can leverage and go about it, and I personally think that's the right way to do it. So the short answer is, yeah, I can answer, Senator Coburn. We have a state that's very involved in the EMAC program. Send a lot of people out there. There's DMORTs, DMATs, and all those things. We have people in my county who are parts of all of those. We have a state that we've been able to work with to the point where they'll vet any training requests we have so that they meet the letter of the law and then they also meet our spirit of the law. And we're developing in-state training capabilities, regionalized specialty teams, things like that to kind of make the money go further. Everything that we buy with a grant has to be deployable elsewhere. We've been doing that all the time, and now it's going to be basically a rule for all grant stuff. It has to be something we can either send somewhere else or a training that supports our ability to send someplace else. And again, it has to be able to be used. And when we have people who request things from us out of a grant, a project they propose, we have them justify all of this up front. They have to tell us how they're going to meet that deployability, the fact that it's not duplicating something else that's already out there, and that it's going to get used. So, since we can't change federal law, what can we do now? Well, hopefully we can help federal laws will change. But the first thing is we local emergency managers can control how we are perceived, at least in part, by being able to justify what we do up front and not doing things that really should be apparently stupid. I'm sorry, I hope no one here is the person who bought that fish tank. I can't understand what you were thinking if you are. The state, well, I won't say, one of the states you may remember bought a snow cone machine. Now, they had a great justification for it written down, but somebody somewhere should have looked at that thing politically and said, hey, this will never fly. We have to keep in mind that emergency management is a program, not a department, and that's a huge deal. That's the reason why I'm involved in the emergency management accreditation program, and I was fortunate enough to be appointed as one of the commissioners, but I highly recommend that standard. I mean, it's the emergency management standard. It's approved by ANSI, so it's a nationally and internationally recognized thing that's out there. And it's got 15 separate things that if you do one each year for 15 years, you're making progress. You can actually measure it. It's a metric, right? And it stresses equal capability, not just what you own, but equal capabilities across your entire jurisdiction. It's not dependent on what you as the emergency manager own or you as the fire chief or police officer own. It's what your entire community can do. Even if you can't afford to go through the accreditation process, and here I am, I'm a commissioner, and I can't afford time or money to go through the full accreditation process, but we're using that standard day to day as our personal standard of how we're doing business around here, and man, it works really well. I talked about it a little bit already. If you meet that standard, it'll help you comply, but if you are complying with the federal and local standards that are, or requirements that DHS or your local state puts on you, that's another metric you can meet. And then if you do your thyra, you know, whether you like the letter T or not, if you do your thyra, identify those gaps and address those gaps, again, you can show metrics right there, right? The other thing that we've chosen to do is try and identify how our capabilities apply across our entire county so that if we have something that, you know, the north side of our county can respond to and the south can't and the response time is too long for some reason, those are the kind of things we address. And last, actually it's the middle bullet there, but don't forget to take a look at the economics and social vulnerabilities within your community. Those are things that you can sometimes influence with just very little money and leverage that money going across. The key then in my world is to build national capability. And again, we talked about that, by building local resilience. We tend to concentrate on these things first. Training and education for our responders, our public works, all those 10 disciplines that FEMA and DHS talk about, that's our biggest bang for the buck as far as I'm concerned. And so that's where most of our grant money goes to, is training and educating and exercising as well. It should say exercising there and it doesn't. But training, education, and exercises are the big things. The second thing is that even though the grants allow us to cover OT and backfill for these classes, we don't do that. It makes our local agencies have some skin in the game. We'll only pay the costs associated with overtime at exercises because of union requirements and things like that. Sometimes it's otherwise impossible to get the police there because they're there on overtime. But other than that, if they're going to go to a training, if they're going to go observe an exercise, if they're going to go to some conference, anything like that, then the local agency's got to pick up their own personnel's costs. We'll cover the travel, we'll cover the tuition, room and board if it's away. Obviously, we stress very much doing stuff in-state just because it's cheaper. And we cross-use everything. We leverage every penny we have. And most importantly is nothing, but nothing stays in the box. If they're not going to use it tomorrow, I will not buy it with the grant today. Talked about how we reuse used equipment, so I'll just skip over that since we're a little short of time and go into sort of where I think we're going to end up. Local capacity building is the big thing. We have that role in the national enterprise of homeland security and emergency management. We have to learn as locals to share capabilities across the border. The days of being able to buy everything ourselves are gone. They've really been gone for a while now, and we need to recognize that. Buying 50 Bearcats, buying the same thing in every county in your region is just not making any sense. We have to remember that the small dogs out there need tools, too. As I said, Minnesota is a sending state for EMACs. So during Katrina, during other events after that, during Sandy, it was Minnesotans, along with other states. I'm not just saying us. But Minnesotans spent weeks and months out in these big areas helping them out because those big dogs were exhausted. So if Minnesota didn't have the funding in place to train to that national level, to form an all-hazards incident management team, to get people trained in the right procedures, there's no way we could help them out, and they'd be worse off. So we've got to convince the federal government that the small dogs still need to be funded. Just because Al-Qaeda may not target your city doesn't mean that you may not be sending help to a city that was targeted. And when the main targets are hit, it's us who send the help. Everyone does not need to have the same capacity in order to achieve capability. We talked about that. You have to look beyond your own agency, and this is the role of your emergency management agency out there. The emergency management agency has to concentrate on building a preparedness program in their jurisdiction, not just building their own department. Finally, it's not about the toys. It just can't be anymore. It can't be about who owns what. We have to take a look at justifying what we do. We have to be able to stand up in front of the news, to answer Senator Coburn, to be willing to take part in something like the National Association of Counties or in the Council of Mayors and get involved. The politics is a huge part of what we do. If you're not talking to your elected officials and if you're not willing to talk to your elected officials, reconsider. Okay? National resilience is going to rely on local resilience. And local resilience is going to require honest assessment of your needs and capabilities, not just a scramble for whatever money we can get. That's a big thing. So, those are my opinions. Some of it's based on scientific fact. A lot of it's just based on having done this for a while and coming out with something that works for my county. I understand it doesn't work for everyone's county. It won't work for everyone's city. I can only tell you what seems to be working here in Ramsey and what I personally believe. If you have questions, I'll be very happy to answer them. And if not, I certainly understand. And then down at the bottom there is my email address. I love getting emails. I'm one of those people who carries an electric leash with me, so I always get them. I'll be happy to answer anything that's even remotely polite. But you can hit me down there. And I think that's pretty much it for the slides. So, Amy, I'll turn it back to you and any questions that the folks might have.
Thank you very much, Judd. We sure do appreciate it. Okay, to ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel. In fact, I'm going to close the chat panel so that we don't get confused about where they go. You just type it in and hit enter, and then I will moderate that. I will read the questions and comments aloud, and then our guests will respond via the bridge. Please keep your question or comment somewhat related to today's topic, although we got an expert in risk here, so any questions on risk might be well welcome. We are also interested in your comments or opinions or experiences with these same kinds of issues. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. And while we're waiting for the first one, I am going to put Judd's contact information back up in case you want to get in touch with him later. All right. Well, Judd, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, you had one of the slides about just how prepared do we need to be. And one of the things that's always struck me about the National Preparedness Goal is that, to me, it didn't seem to articulate a vision or, you know, maybe a 10-year goal or, you know, steps to meeting that goal. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's apologies to the administration. I think it's a poorly conceived document and a poorly conceived concept. The entire nation isn't the same. So national preparedness goals should reflect that, and they tend not to. Again, they were driven by terrorism. If you look at the letters of some of the laws that govern the grants that are out there, they're tied to Al-Qaeda-based international terrorism, specifically tied to that. So, you know, homegrown terrorism doesn't count. The Animal Liberation Front or the Earth Liberation Front don't count. While working at the university, I was, you know, personally attacked by the ELF. They tried to burn my car, but that wouldn't count. And that's what drove me to the concept of trying to leverage this money, you know, for those maximum of practical maximums. If I can use something to deal with how we're going to cope with the Animal Liberation Front setting a firebomb off, I can use that exact same capability to deal with Al-Qaeda setting off a firebomb. They meet the same goals. My hostage negotiator's skills are going to be the same if the person on the other side is just a deranged individual having a bad day, or if they're, you know, holding hostages for some political or social motivation.
And that goes back to our all hazards approach.
I'm a huge believer in all hazards. I've been doing this now for 26 years or something like that, and I remember the days where, you know, we would change. You know, at one point it was all civil defense, and then after Bhopal it became, you know, all hazardous materials, and then we went all hazards, and now we seem to be kind of turning back on that and trying to specialize. I got to tell you the truth. New York City Fire Department was effective after 9/11, not because they had a plan for how to deal with Al-Qaeda striking a building, but because they had a plan for what would happen if their command staff was done. Remember, you know, they lost most of their command staff, but they still put out fires in the Bronx. You know, that came from simply all hazards preparedness, and they weren't as good then as they are now.
And if we have time, I want to come back to the idea of this very low probability, high consequence events and who's responsible for those. But we do have a few questions in the queue now, so we'll move on to those. And Ava Jean asks, how difficult was it to get all the jurisdictions to go and adopt one county plan? I find that amazing. And by jurisdictions, she means the cities within your county.
Well, we had to, talk to them first. It wasn't something where I could come by and say, we are doing this no matter what because we're the big bad county. That would not have worked. We have the same political differences that everybody else has between communities. And what it ended up being was simply pointing out the realities were that, particularly post 9/11, there are more and more and more requirements coming down on emergency management. Minnesota has some specific laws. I'm assuming that I know a few other states do, but I assume that all other states have specific laws, requirements for their local emergency managers to do. And we were doing them 19 times, and it made no sense. There was not enough money to pay for it. So my local emergency manager's day-to-day compliance stuff was made easier. We lessened their workload without increasing their tax burden. And once we were able to demonstrate with that, we had 100% of our communities, except for the city of St. Paul, the city of the first class, they weren't part of that. And we coordinate plans with them, but they are a city of the first class, and that's a different thing. My communities are mostly in the 30,000 to 50,000 person range, and then I've got some that are down in the 5 or 10,000. So they're, relatively large suburban communities. And when we confronted them with, look, you have to do all of these things, we have to do all of those things, and then we have to validate that you did them all for almost no money, they were more than willing to let us do the work. So it actually worked a lot easier than I would have expected.
I would see that taking that approach might help bring to light some erroneous planning assumptions and that you all could get on board together with what the actual planning assumptions might be. Did you find that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that we've noticed is going on around us, one of our counties, I won't mention them because I haven't talked to them and told them I would mention them, but they're larger than we are geographically, and they, because of that geographic thing, one plan doesn't fit their entire county. So they divided their county into regions, the planning regions, and so they have, I think it's 2 or 3 plans total. But that even that is much easier to coordinate and much easier to solve those erroneous planning processes. And when we meet, I meet monthly with all of our municipal emergency managers and the city of St. Paul. We all meet together and we discuss, things of import, and they pick up the phone and call me, or at those meetings they tell me, hey, this isn't working. And when we exercise, this isn't working. So we try and solve it together. It also, by the way, forms a really great basis for a local emergency planning committee, which meets another rule in law as well, because you got people who are really, emergency managers from multiple disciplines who are really interested in what you do.
And I do remember your area certainly got kudos when that bridge collapsed. It was obvious that training had paid off and that coordination.
No, absolutely. And it's not that everything was perfect there. There were stuff, and there's still political fallout, as there always will be. But, man, it was a whole lot better than anybody thought it would have gone. And, we had that thing under control pretty quick and coordinated hundreds of entities all at once. And so, the county that was affected, it was an interstate highway falling into a federal waterway at rush hour in a giant city. All those things going on at once with some real political stuff going on the sides, and it all worked out.
Okay, question from Amy Crabell. She says, great presentation. Is it better to rely on continued federal funding of our programs, parentheses, on average 30% by EMPG of EM budgets, DHS funds, and 75% of declared disaster funds, or begin to build locally sustainable programs by making difficult local choices? And I think the nub she's getting to here is, should we be looking for our own sustainable funding sources?
Well, only if you want a job. We have to. The federal money is going to go away. The economic situation in the United States is tough. And most of us, and myself included, by the way, are grant dependent. This is a do as I say, not as I do moment. My budget right now, my local budget is only about 60% levy funded, and it's about 40% grant funded. We are trying really hard. In fact, in this upcoming budget year, my county has agreed. I have one full-time employee who is completely grant-funded. She's coming off the grant and onto the levy, even at a time where we don't have much money. But they bought into the idea. It took me 10 years to get here, by the way. But they bought into the idea that, having the capability that she offers to us, she's my exercise, training, and compliance officer. She does all three of those jobs. You know, and she's an emergency manager, and so she also fills one of our duty officer slots. They've decided that it's worth that money per year from the local coffers to be able to make sure we can continue to do those functions. It's not an easy thing to do, but I 100% believe we need to use the grants to build. If it's federal money, it should meet a national goal. And if they want us to meet a national goal, there has to be federal money. I'm a big believer in the Constitution and in the intent of that. My local taxpayers want me to take care of them first and then meet the national need secondly.
All right, we've just got time for a couple more here. Michael Farinacci, and he asks, I'm not sure where he's coming from, but he asks, have you seen problems with government agencies partnering with private industries? For instance, a government unit using or trying to acquire an agreement to use private facilities in the event that an alternate facility is needed during an incident. And if you want to expand on that a little bit, you know, maybe you could tell us a little bit about involving the private sector if you do.
Well, we do involve it. We just actually, our county went out and did the Integrated Emergency Management course out at EMI, and we brought private sector representatives with us because they do, you know, have a lot of stuff we don't have. Getting memoranda of understanding with them is, of course, a legal issue that can be problematic. One of the things I noted that in the Secretary's proposed National Preparedness Grant program, which Congress kind of slapped down yesterday, but the Secretary had proposed expanding the definition of local government to include private sector people, and I'm absolutely against that concept. But involving the private sector, we have some, you know, very large companies in this nation that provide a lot of things and can get them to us better than we can. They're better at some of the stuff than we are at. And so working with those companies, and you can guess who they are, but working with those companies I think is a critical thing. There's an organization here in Minnesota that actually has physical seats in our state EOC, and we have physical seats in our county EOC for that organization to have a representative as well.
And do you actually have MOUs or MOAs with any private sector for resources?
We have them actually at the county attorney's office as we speak. This morning, that's what I was doing before I called in, actually was working on those with my county attorney, because the short answer is no. We have agreements in principle, letters of intent, that kind of stuff, but we don't have the actual physical MOU, and we want that. And so do our private sector partners. So stay tuned. I believe we're on the actual last thing. They should be ready shortly, and then we'll start trying to get them signed.
And you're working on it. Good deal. Let's see. I wanted to come back a little bit to the maximum of maximums that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Being megaton bomb. I had a little experience where, you know, I was just saying had a planning requirements for like a 10 kiloton or whatever size device, and I was, you know, I had the same exact response that you stated, which was like, well, we'll be gone. just because of the size of the community I was in and so forth. So how do you want me to plan for this? And I'm wondering, do you feel that there's a little maybe a little shifting or attempt to, I've heard other people say this, and I just wonder what your thought was. You know, in my mind, any kind of nuclear device would be a federal response. Do you think the feds are trying to shift that down to us, perchance?
Well, I hate to single out the nuclear bomb. That was just, you know, the one that I chose on. You know, the adage that all disasters are local is 100% true 100% of the time. And the recovery after the feds go away is still ours. As I mentioned, in Minneapolis, they're still recovering from a storm 2 years ago. You know, more Oklahoma is going to be recovering from that storm for a decade. And the feds will go away, and it will still be on us. So there has to be some look at how we as the locals are going to take care of our own people and our own the businesses that support our tax base and things like that. Where I have problems with the national preparedness goals is they're too ridiculously specific. There's just too much to them. They could be broadened somewhat. And again, the all-hazards approach method is, to me, the best way to do it. It's been working. And because there were some problems, they threw the entire program out, and now you're starting to have specific annexes for response to this versus that again. I think that's a bad choice. I've been, you know, fortunate enough through NACO to have the ability to voice that to DHS. You know, I really urge all of you out there who are local emergency managers to get involved with your state government, get involved with national organizations where you can have a little say into what goes on there. And, you know, if the folk, I'm a big fan of Administrator Fugate. I think he's actually been one of our better administrators, and I've had the privilege of knowing the man for a few years now. And you know, I'm able to talk to him and to some of his assistant secretaries and, you know, all those people there and tell them my opinion. They actually do listen. They sometimes ignore you, but they do listen. And all of you have that. You know, I'm nothing special. I'm an emergency manager in a small Midwestern county. Happens to have a lot of people in it, but, you know, we're flyover territory, and yet I've had the opportunity to testify before Congress. It's not because I am brilliant or wonderful, although I would say I am. It's not because of that. It's because I was willing to open my mouth and to say something. And, you know, now I have phone numbers for people. I can pick up the phone and call assistant secretaries. It's not because I'm special. It's because I talked to them and they found out that, you know, I have real concerns and they're willing to talk.
I remember the one last thing I was going to ask you about. Okay, I guess it was a year or so ago that DHS, as part of the president's budget proposal, had floated this integrated approach, redesign the grant program to be more integrated, and you mentioned that it did get shot down again yesterday, I believe.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could just give us a little bit about the pros and cons of that approach.
Well, the pros of block granting is simply the fact that there isn't as much money as there used to be, and we as locals are going to have to recognize that and make the hard choices. The cons were, and again, I'm coming from that of being a local government person, not a state person, so there'll be others who will disagree, and that's fine. But the cons were that it took all the programs and put them to one big block grant, and as anyone who's ever seen block grants before, they're referred to as block and chops, because once you make the block grant, it becomes very easy to cut them. It gave all of the authority to the state administrative agency to make the decisions for what would be needed at the local level. And it neglected sustainment of concepts that were already in place. You know, we spent $39 billion. You can't just walk away from that. We've got to figure out a better way. I do think 16 separate grant programs, plus the Fire Act grant program, plus the Emergency Management Performance Grant, is probably overkill. And so, you know, a number of other organizations are working on alternate concepts. The first thing is the Emergency Management Performance Grant is critical, I think, to national resilience. That grant should be continued as a separate grant program forever and ever, amen. It's what allows local emergency management agencies to help other emergency management agencies. I do think we have to get better at the local level of not relying on that grant for our major funding, you know, 30% and 40% of our operational budgets. But that grant has to be protected and kept the same. Congress is doing that, and even the National Preparedness Grant Program didn't take that one away. There is value to things like the Urban Area Grant to address the highest risk for terrorism cities with specific spending to help them deal with terrorists. There is benefit to taking some grants that are duplicative and combining them so that at least, you know, we get down to one or two applications. The NPGP, as proposed by the Secretary, was designed with inadequate input from local government, and that was its major problem. They need to talk to the cities, they need to talk to the counties, they need to talk to the first responder organizations, and we need to put together a joint method of addressing the dwindling funds and what the intent of those dwindling funds would be. On our end, the local government end, we need to be able to show progress, and that's again where I highly recommend our EMAP standard. That document there can help you show progress. It is a metric. It's something you can actually show them, even if you don't go through the whole process. If we do that, and if we stop spending money on silly things and start spending money on things that we can literally justify to the media in terms that they'll understand, and then, you know, propose something that makes a little more sense and saves some money across the board, I think we can build something really good. The problem is when, you know, we have the states against the locals, against the cities, that's where our problems come from.
Also, stay tuned on that. Maybe we'll see some other proposals that will reflect the kind of consensus if we take the time to build it.
Right.
Okay, on that note, we will wrap it up for today. So on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants, thank you very much, Judd, for joining us today and hanging in there with us. We definitely appreciate you. I know we ran over on our schedule here, but it was, I think, very worthwhile, and we appreciate you sharing your ideas with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invite. Appreciate it.
So, man, you've given us some food for thought, and we do wish you the best in your future endeavors.
Thank
folks,
you.
We're losing folks fast. I don't blame them. If you haven't already, please do take a moment to give us a little feedback via the form here. And our next program is scheduled for June 12th when instructor August Vernon returns to focus on responding to incidents involving improvised or homemade explosive devices. So please, everyone enjoys August when we have him. So please do make plans to join us then. Thanks, everyone, for hanging in with us today, and have a wonderful afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you. Bye now.
Thanks, Amy.